Hello and welcome to this week's Standing with Refugees podcast, and thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Hutchings, one of the founders of Refugee Support Europe, and this week I'm talking to Sharon Sylvie of Refucom. Hello, Sharon.
Hi, Paul. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again. We saw each other in Chios last year, but actually we first started communicating when I was working in Calais, which was nearly 3 years ago.
It was 2015, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Late 2015.
Well, we might come back to some of that, but before we do, can you tell us a bit about Refucom and what you do?
Okay, well, Refucom provides information to refugees in Greece about their rights and the asylum procedures. So what we try to do is to help people to navigate the complicated procedures via our website, via our Facebook pages, via being with people in the camps, and through various other means, like we give information on micro SD cards and in many other ways.
Mm. I mean, I definitely want to talk about the micro SD cards because I think that is a brilliant piece of innovation and, you know, really well thought out and a great thing in lots of ways. But on the information, it's interesting because as an organisation, one of the first things we did as a volunteer organisation where we have lots of people coming over is have a very clear control or kind of a rule, I suppose, for volunteers, which was that no one is to talk about asylum or legal issues because it was so sensitive and it was complicated. And even now, I'm still, having worked in this sector for over 2 years, I'm still confused. How do you keep on top of it all?
Well, that's the problem. And that's a problem that we've had, you know, for a long time. People are scared to give what they call legal information, but actually it's not really legal information, it's procedural information. There's a set procedure to follow to claim asylum. The rights are written down in law, but that doesn't make it legal information. These are your rights. And people are scared of that. You know, they think it's legal information. We don't claim to be lawyers. We don't claim to be giving people legal information. What we do is give people information. These are your rights. These are the procedures. And this is what you need to do. So we're not scared of it because it's not rocket science. You don't have to be a lawyer to be able to understand a process. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the main worry is, I guess, from volunteers is about giving the wrong information. And the procedures are complicated, you know, don't get me wrong. So what we've been doing over the last 2 years in Greece is trying to break down those procedures into really simple instructions, if you like, for people, including volunteers. You know, we've just produced a series of training videos for volunteers on the procedures on the Greek islands, and the procedures on the Greek islands at the Greek sea borders are much more complicated than the procedures on the mainland, because the procedures on the islands, you've got the EU-Turkey deal, you've got this extra layer called admissibility where people could be returned to Turkey. So what we've tried to do is to break it down for people, refugees and volunteers alike. And in our experience, you know, hundreds, thousands of volunteers use our information so that they can give people accurate information. So it's just about taking the fear really out of the procedures. And that's what we do. You know, we've broken it down not just into, we started by breaking it down into written information and breaking down the language and making the language simple for people to understand. We've tried to do that as much as we can. Sometimes it's not possible because legal speak is legal speak, but we do try. And then once we've broken down the documents, we realized that people weren't really engaging with the written word. It was okay for volunteers, they could understand it, but the refugees couldn't understand it because literacy levels are really poor amongst the refugee community. You know, there hasn't been any formal research being done on literacy levels, but our experience and our own research, we did a small sample last year on Chios, shows that as much as 80% of the people that we come across in Greece don't read. Now, those are our unofficial figures based on what we know, but we were finding this really, really early on when we were working on the mainland. You know, we were showing these documents to people. We were putting info points up in squats and camps, and people just weren't interested. We were showing documents to women, unaccompanied minors, and they were just shaking their fingers at us and going, no, no, don't read. So very, very quickly, you know, in 2016, we started to make information more accessible to people by producing audio files, and then we started to produce films so that people could, you know, everyone could access information about the procedures. And we eventually, we even made an animation, and now we've got lots of animations. So, That's what we do. It is scary. You know, if it's scary for volunteers, can you imagine how scary that is for a refugee arriving? They don't understand even the basics of what's happening to them. When they arrive, they go to the reception and identification centre on the islands, and they get really brief information about their rights. You have the right to claim asylum. That's basically it. And then they don't really get any guidance from there. The other problem is that they get this information as soon as they arrive, when they've just got off the boat, they're wet, they're traumatized. So it's really important that they get information going forward, not just on the fact how to claim asylum. That's quite simple. And it's quite guided when you're in a camp. You know, you have an appointment, you go here, you go there. It's really important that they understand where they are in the procedure, what that means to them, what they need to do, what they need to say, how they prepare for their interviews. So that's basically what we try to do. In short, after all of that, we're trying to break down these procedures in a really simple, accessible and easy to understand way for both refugees and for volunteers.
Mm. I mean, what's so reassuring about you is that you do have quality information that is accurate. And one of the things that I know, having worked on the camps and with people who've come from all over the world, is that there's often kind of rumour and misinformation about, you know, what you should do and how it works and, you know, ways to get around it. And you hear all these sorts of stories all the time. And so our approach has been always like, yeah, there is Refucom, or on the camps, there's the UNHCR. Or there's the DRC or whoever is the agency that's responsible. And that's, and we've just sort of said, look, any kind of discussion of asylum, go and see that agency there.
Yeah. But, you know, they can still help people with the basics, you know, like the process, for example. You need to fully register, then this will happen, you'll get your interview. Then if you're rejected, you need to appeal. And just knowing these basics for a refugee is really, really important. Yeah. You know, because they haven't got a clue what's happening to them. I do really understand why volunteers are afraid, if you like, of the procedures, but I really don't think that they need to be. They just need to make sure that if they are sharing information, that it's up to date.
Yeah.
And we try very, very hard to make sure our information is up to date. I mean, on the islands, for example, we are the only organisation since 2016 who provide detailed information about the Greek sea border procedures. So it's not just volunteers that are afraid of this, in my experience, it's the organisations themselves. It's either nervousness or it's deliberate. You know, why wouldn't they do that?
I mean, it definitely is a huge gap. And I mean, I think even, you know, when we've said to people go and see the UNHCR, they've often not got a satisfactory response. And there's a lot of, like I say, there's just a lot of rumour and chat and misinformation on the camps. And I mean, for something that seems so important for people's futures, it seems to me that they are terribly kind of uninformed about, you know, the next steps or how things are going to be progressing in the future. Is this how you started off? Did you think, I want to get into legal information, or how did that happen?
Well, no, I mean, first of all, we started on the Balkan route in 2015. We were helping to build camps, infrastructure, organising distribution channels in Hungary, Croatia and Serbia. And at that time, independent volunteers like us came together from all over Europe, you'll remember it well, to provide a first aid response to people travelling from Athens, really, to the rest of Europe. That's how we started. We created a mother and baby unit in Serbia where mothers could feed their children, get dry clothes and shower. Brilliant. We had a triage system going with Médecins Sans Frontières to take care of their medical needs. But after a while, the situation calmed down when the route was established. But the whole time I was working hard to provide this first aid response, I was always really aware from my contact with refugees that the broader needs of people who were travelling weren't being met. I was listening to what people were saying, and what they were telling me they wanted was information. I mean, many people were arriving. They didn't even know what country they were in. They were arriving with their families after, you know, travelling all that way. The buses were dropping them in the middle of fields. They didn't know which border they were at. They were scared that they were in Hungary. Why are they taking my fingerprints? Why do I need to register? How does that affect my legal status? Do I have to claim asylum here? They wanted information, and they wanted it in their language. They needed other things as well in the whole broader scheme of things, like SIM cards and mobile phones, phone charging, internet. And so that's when we first shifted our focus from first aid response to information provision. So We built mobile phone charging units in the middle of a field, these great big wooden boards with mobile phone. We bought secondhand phones so that we could lend them to them to phone home, unaccompanied minors in particular, to phone home and say to their mum, "I'm okay, mum." We bought SIM cards and raised money to pay for people to travel on the buses. And I launched the Facebook page, RefuCom, and that's how I was born. Great. So what happened, though, is we realised very quickly that, you know, current response frameworks and mechanisms are really not equipped to manage real complexities, I think, of forced displacement on this scale. Yeah. Then, of course, the borders closed, and that's when we shifted our focus to Greece. We went to Idomeni, and we realised very quickly that people would need to claim asylum, that the borders weren't going to open, and that's when we got to work. We had a look around, see what information was available, and the only information that was available was on the Greek Asylum Service website, and it was all in Greek. So that's when we started to pick apart the procedures, and we came up with some really rudimentary documents in the beginning. You need, the borders are not going to open, you need to claim asylum, this is what you need to do. And it grew from there, really, and we created the website, then the documents, then the films and the audios, and eventually we were working with refugees in on a feeder camp in Ritsona. We were trying to show them the films, and then we realised Wi-Fi access just wasn't available. I was holding up my phone and trying to load the films, and they weren't loading. So the
can
first
I just say, actually, on that is, yeah. I know that the camps where we work, there's Wi-Fi access, but they block all video content to manage the bandwidth.
Well, I've just learned something completely new. I just thought it was Greek internet.
Completely nuts, but it varies from camp to camp, but that's common. That's a common practice.
So, well, to get around that, we loaded all the films onto a USB stick, bought a projector and started showing them in the camps and doing workshops with people. But the problem of how we get this information to the masses still persisted. People don't really like using websites anyway. Many people aren't that tech savvy. If you're talking to an Afghan woman who can't read, you can't expect her to even access the website. That's when we hit upon the idea of having all of the films and documents loaded onto micro SD cards, because then we could just give them out to everybody. They could stick them in their phones and watch them to their heart's content. And so that's where we are now, really. We're still producing the films. We're just about to produce films in Kamanji and Sirani for people arriving from Afrin and Iraq. And we're still continuing with the micro SD card project. We've given out 1,000 cards now in Greece. We need a lot more, obviously. Needs List have just hooked us up with TripAdvisor, who have a volunteer campaign on for the month of June, and they've agreed to buy 600 for us and load them up in their Oxford office, which is amazing.
Good on TripAdvisor, and also, you know, huge shout out to Needs List and Natasha as well, who continues to be really helpful to everybody.
She's really wonderful. I think what they're doing is quite visionary, to be honest. You know, they're really professional. They really work hard. They seem to be making all the right connections, the right noises. They've been such a help to us. You know, it was through Needs List that we got the 1,000 cards in the first place. They've helped us a lot with volunteers as well. And they're just really supportive. I can talk to them about anything and they give support. I love them.
Yeah, and anyone listening as well, I also spoke to Natasha on one of the podcasts, which you'll find on our feed, if you'd be interested in hearing how she set up Needs List and what they do. It's a great conversation with someone who is, as Sharon, as you were saying there, really smart and switched on. So, yeah, you mentioned Needs List there, who obviously a great source of funding for those of us who are buying stuff. I imagine over the last couple of years you have had to ask for money.
Yeah, it really is a challenge for
us.
Yes, it is. Most of the work that we've done has been paid for by family and friends. Yeah. Pip, a member of our team who lives in LA now, ran the London Marathon to keep us going last year. She also was the one who funded the first animation completely. You know, we've relied on family and friends. We've applied for many, many grants, and we've only been successful once, and that's because goes back to what I was saying before. Information just isn't in the forefront of people's minds. They don't understand how important it is. So we've tried. We've really, really tried. You know, we've tried through our own marketing to try and get people to understand how important information is, but it's just not happening. So that's one of our biggest challenges, really. To do what we do, we don't need a lot of funding.
How much does it cost to buy an SD card?
SD cards, depends. If we buy them in bulk, we can get them for about, well, Natasha, she does the sourcing for us, but I think we're getting them for about €5 each now. And they're good SD cards. You know, we generally tend to not buy anything less than 8 gigs so that they can put their documents on there as well, which go missing all the time. And they can put their family photos and all that kind of thing on the SD cards as well.
Can people donate directly on your website or somewhere, Sharon?
They can, yeah. We've got a donation link on our website. We've also got a donation link on our Facebook page. But we've also got a needs list, so they can buy directly from needs list, which is probably an easier way to do it.
Yeah.
But that, again, is also on our donation link on our website. There's a link to needs list. But, you know, the other thing that we need funding for is not just the micro SD cards. You know, we have operating costs. They're really, really minimal. Like, for example, we have to pay people sometimes to do voiceovers. We have to pay for translations. You know, our translation bill's quite high every year. Things like that. And we're managing so far. And if we don't get funding, we still continue to operate anyway. We just do it ourselves and we call in experts and get them to try and help us. But there's less help out there than there was before. People,
yeah,
you know,
it's tougher.
People are wondering, it's much tougher. So I don't know how long, you know, there's a limit to how long we can continue to do what we do without funding. The other issue that we have is that we're not in Greece all the time. It's costly for us to go to Greece. We pay for that ourselves, but we've come to a stage now where we can't continue to do that. It's important that we are on the ground. We don't have to be on the ground all the time, but we need to be on the ground to build partnerships and that kind of thing. And that's really what we need. That's really what we'd like funding for now, to enable us to actually be on the ground and sharing, making sure that our work gets shared.
Yeah. Well, I hope that comes off and maybe someone listening can help with that, because, like I say, it's so important. And, you know, especially as someone who is, you know, like an organisation that still is doing food and clothing. And yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what I say to people a lot is that, yeah, we offer food and clothing and that's important. You know, that people get some cash and we're not keeping people alive by giving them food. We're offering something supplementary, which is useful because they don't have a lot of cash. You know, the diapers and sanitary wear and all these kind of other extras that we give definitely help their tight budgets to go a bit further. So that's all good. But actually, you know, the food and clothing is a vehicle for offering something, I think, more important, which is about giving people a bit of normality, helping people understand that they're not alone, that there are people who really care about them and want to do the best for them and treat them like just like normal human beings, like everybody else. So that's the thing. But I mean, people say, they regularly ask, you know, what's the one thing that would make a big difference on the camp? And to me, if I was to really boil it down to one thing, it would be that, I mean, I say on the camps, but the one thing that Greece, let's talk about Greece, one thing Greece could do to make the situation better would be to process people's applications really quickly.
Yeah. Well, we can't influence that really, because that's not up to us. But what we can do is give people some control over that whole process, you know, by giving them some kind of understanding of what that process is and what they need to do, what their responsibility is, you know, so that they can be architects of their own future. So it kind of goes hand in hand with what you're saying. You're talking about aid, giving them more dignity, giving them a little bit of control over their budget, so that they can choose what they spend that money on, whether they spend it on vegetables to supplement the awful food that they're fed in the camps. I know, I've seen it. Food is really important. But we can influence by helping them to understand what they need to do. And some of the things are so basic, you know, it makes me want to cry, quite honestly, when I hear someone say that they had an asylum interview, that the translator didn't speak their language, and so couldn't communicate what they were saying properly, but they didn't know that they could stop the interview. You know, it's basic stuff like that. And this is why it's so important that they know and they understand that. When they arrive, for example, it's really important for them to mention any disability that they have, but they don't know that. And if they are particularly vulnerable, then they get treated in a different way. So it's really important that they mention those vulnerabilities when they first arrive. They need to understand as well, take for example on the island, that if what interview they're being asked to attend and that they need to get ready for. You know, so many people I've spoken to go to the admissibility interview, for example, where they have an interview to decide whether Greece is responsible for them or whether Turkey is responsible for them. But they go there and they talk about what happened to them in their own country. And this has really devastating effects on their asylum application. So these are really, really basic things. And that's all we give them. We give them the basic information. You know, when you go to this interview, you need to talk about why Turkey isn't safe for you, not why your own country. So make sure you know which interview you're being asked to attend. It's really basic information that people need. and to give them some control over their lives. So it's also aid with dignity. Yeah.
Joan, you say again, you said several times, we and us, when you talk about the work that you're doing, but I mean, it's mostly just you, right?
Well, yeah. No, it's not. I drive it.
Yeah.
But, the way we work is that, we believe that refugees are assets, not a burden. That's kind of been our philosophy right from the very beginning. Refugees help us to translate. They help us to get this information shared. They help us when we're in the camps. They help us to do our research, everything. So we have a huge team of refugees that work with us. And rather than being a hierarchical organization, we do things more on a task-based approach. So when we've got a film to make about a particular subject, we consult with the experts. So we will partner then, like we did with the films as an example, with the legal team, Legal Centre Lesbos, who check the scripts that we write. And then we also have another partner, Translators Without Borders, who do the translations. Then we get the refugees involved by telling us what they want. And then we go and find the experts. Then we make the films. Then we go back and we test everything that we do with refugees. So we'll go out and we'll say, is this what you wanted? Then they say yes or no, change that. And then we launch it. And it works well like that. I mean, it's sometimes a bit stressful because, but it works, it means that everyone's involved. And, it's really important for us. What we do is for refugees and by refugees. Otherwise, we'd be hypocrites if we didn't do that. And I think, that's actually something that's really missing in this whole crisis.
It's a crisis, yeah.
Yeah. That's what's missing. We should be asking the beneficiaries of what we do what it is they want, and we pride ourselves on always doing that, which is why we spent a long time last year on kiosks with focus group discussions asking people what they wanted. We found out, do you get information? No. Okay, what information do you need? What languages do you need it in? What formats do you need it in? And we did comprehension testing as well with Translators Without Borders, and that's when we realized that people didn't understand what was written on paper, whether that was because they couldn't read or whether they just weren't engaging with written format. But we tried everything, so we know that what we're doing is what's needed. I mean, it's like saying to people what you do, how would you like us to distribute this? Do you want to get in a queue? Do you want a ticket system? What is more dignified for you? And that's really important, and it doesn't happen enough, and I think it doesn't happen enough particularly from the bigger organisations. It's a very much Western European-led effort, and we need to move away from that, the traditional way of doing things. We're really proud of ourselves for the way we
Yeah, well done, because it's not easy to do it that way. It's in some ways it's a lot easier to to do what the big organisations often do, which is to decide what's best and then just to impose it. And I think it kind of goes hand in hand with charity and aid, that when you're giving it out, then the beneficiaries, which is the kind of word that gets used a lot, should be grateful, even when it's not really what they want. And I mean, we have to fight against that one a lot. And sometimes we're also guilty of thinking, oh, well, we know best here what's working. But, sometimes it works for a little while and then it comes back to bite you.
Yeah, it doesn't in our work, though. If we don't ask people what they want, then we're providing them with something that they really don't need. We can't always do things in a democratic way in a situation like that. Yeah. But we can. So there's nothing to stop us from doing that. It works. Yeah. It works in a really good way.
It's a brilliant story, Sharon. And, I think thousands of people will have benefited from all of that information that you've given out, and all of those people that you've included in that. I think it's fantastic. So, really, really well done.
Thank you. It's not easy.
I mean, on that personally, I have this conversation with people quite a lot. My guess is that you have a very understanding family.
Yeah, my husband's really great. I mean, he's getting a little bit more frustrated with me, particularly because this is really affecting my health. And I think that's a common problem with volunteers.
Yep.
But my family do support me. My son built our website, and he built it completely from code. Right. He does all the updates, and it's amazing. And he built it from code because WordPress doesn't handle languages very well. Huh. So he's absolutely amazing. I don't know how much that would have cost me if I'd have had a paid web developer. So I'm so grateful for him for doing that. So I'm supported in that way. My husband supports me. But as I said, and he always has, and he always will. And one of the reasons he supports me in this work is because he's Jewish, and his mother and aunties were in concentration camps. So he really understands the problems of being a refugee. and how it affects life. But, you know, on the same hand, he's worried about my health because I do spend far too much time working, not enough time sleeping, not enough, you know, not eating the right things. And you know, it's psychologically, it's stressful because not only are you trying to provide aid to people, help to people, but you also take on all the emotional stuff that comes out of that. You know, information and communication is working two ways. So every time we communicate with someone from the refugee community, we usually get to hear their story. We also have a really broad understanding of what's happening to them. Mm. And that has an effect on health.
Yeah.
You know, we know that stress has an effect on health. So I think it's really important, and I need to make myself do this, is to sometimes take a step back and just say, actually, I'm going to take some time out now, reflect on all of this, because there comes a time, I don't know if it's happened to you, but I know that it's happened to lots of my friends. You just get to a stage where you get to a brick wall. I can't take any more of this horror. So I'm saying this, but I'm not very good at it, but I'm trying to get better.
Yes, I mean, I think it is really difficult. I find it's a real roller coaster, and so I know that roller coaster can be something that, you know, over the course of months, you know, like some months where I'm really ploughing through it, and other months where I'm thinking this is great, and it can happen on a daily basis as well. So I can start off the day not feeling great at all, and then end it feeling brilliantly, or the other way around.
I know when it's time for me to take a step back, when there are days when I get up and I think I really don't want to do this, but then, you know, I had a day like that yesterday, and today I woke up and I thought, let's do this.
Let's have a conversation.
Let's get on with this. And, you know, I've got lots to do to prepare for now for the TripAdvisor thing. We've got the voiceovers are coming now for the Comanche and Serrani film, so that means lots of editing. But what I have to do now is to make sure that I don't sort of hyper-focus and try and get things done too quickly and to the detriment of my health. And that's something that I'm always guilty of.
Yeah, and I hear that a lot as well. So please do look after yourself. Thank you for all that you've been doing, Sharon. Thanks for spending a bit of time with us today. It's really, really lovely to hear your story and all that great work you've been doing.
Thank you very much. Well, we admire your work too.
Great.
Yeah, we think what you do is absolutely amazing.
We just keep on keeping on.
Yeah, we do. We have to, because this ain't going to go away, is it?
No, unfortunately not.
Yeah, but what we have to realise, and I love cliches, is that it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you, Sharon, for standing with refugees, and thank you to everyone listening. We talk to someone every week and make it available to download on Mondays, trying to do every Monday. You can subscribe on Podbean and iTunes, download. You can find it on our website. Please tell us what you think by email, paul@refugeesupport.eu. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you name it, do a search, you'll find us. And if you have any suggestions or feedback, then please do get in touch. Thank you.